A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's what Daniel sent us. He's pointing out something that should be obvious, but somehow isn't. Trump and Kushner both come out of Manhattan real estate development, a very specific pressure cooker in a very specific part of the world. And that shared background probably shaped how this administration approaches negotiations with Iran in ways that aren't immediately obvious. So the question is, what does that pressure cooker actually look like day to day? And how does the cognitive toolkit you developed there map onto nuclear diplomacy?
The same mental model that closes a $400 million condo tower deal is driving negotiations with a hostile state that could have a nuclear weapon inside a decade. That is not an exaggeration. And the timing matters here. We're approaching the June 2026 deadline for renewed talks. The snapback of UN sanctions happened last September, and the administration is running what it calls Maximum Pressure 2.0. If we don't understand the negotiator's cognitive toolkit, we cannot predict what happens next.
Walk me through it. What does that world actually look like? Because most people hear real estate developer and picture someone flipping houses or building a strip mall. Manhattan is not that.
Manhattan is not that. Manhattan commercial real estate development is arguably the most high-stakes, short-time horizon, leverage-obsessed business environment in the world. And I want to define what we're actually talking about here. This is not about Trump's personality. It's not armchair psychology. It's about professional path dependency. Spend 30 years in a system that rewards certain instincts and punishes others, and those instincts become how you see every problem.
So the grooves get worn deep enough that you stop noticing they're there.
And we can map this in three parts. First, what the pressure cooker actually looks like, the day-to-day mechanics of Manhattan development. Second, the specific cognitive toolkit that environment produces. Third, how that toolkit maps onto Iran negotiations with specific decisions the administration has made. Let's start with the pressure cooker.
Take me through a typical day. Paint the picture.
6:30 a.m., you're on the phone with your construction lender. Interest is accruing daily on a $200 million loan. Your loan maturity is 18 months out, which in development time means you're already late. 7 a.m., your general contractor emails that steel prices just jumped 8% because of tariffs, and your budget was locked in 6 months ago. 8 a.m., you're on site at 57th Street, walking the floors with the construction manager, and you discover the curtain wall installation is 3 weeks behind schedule. Every week of delay is costing you somewhere between $100,000 and $200,000 in carrying costs.
Before you've even had coffee.
10 a.m., you're at a city council zoning subcommittee hearing. Your project needs a discretionary approval, a variance, a special permit, and three council members have questions about shadow impacts on a nearby park. You've donated to two of their campaigns. The third one is new and hasn't been socialized yet, as they say. That's a lunch meeting you need to schedule.
The euphemism is doing a lot of work there.
It always does. Noon, you're at lunch with a potential anchor tenant. A hedge fund that wants 40,000 square feet but needs the lobby finished to their specifications. And by the way, their lease signing is contingent on you hitting your delivery date, which you're already worried about missing. 2 p.m., you're renegotiating with your mechanical subcontractor who claims an unforeseen condition is going to add $600,000 to his scope. 4 p.m., you're on a call with your equity partners, the people who put up the actual cash, the last money in the capital stack, and they want to know why the projected IRR has dropped from 22% to 18.5%.
IRR being internal rate of return.
The annualized return on their investment. And an 18% IRR versus 22% over a 3-year hold period means millions of dollars difference in their payout. They are not happy. 6 p.m. Dinner with the borough president's chief of staff. The borough president has an advisory role on land use, and you need their support, or at least their non-opposition, on the next phase. 9 p.m. You're back at your desk reviewing the updated pro forma, and you realize the numbers don't work unless you can squeeze another 15% in rentable square footage out of the floor plate, which means going back to the architect.
That's one day.
That's a Tuesday. And every single interaction I just described involves a negotiation. With lenders, with contractors, with politicians, with tenants, with partners. The developer sits at the center of a web of competing interests, and every single party is trying to extract something. The developer's job is to manage all of them simultaneously while keeping the project moving forward.
Let's talk about the capital stack, because you mentioned it, and that's where a lot of the pressure comes from. What is it?
The capital stack is the layered financing structure that funds a development project. At the bottom, you have senior debt. That's the construction loan from a bank, typically 60 to 65% of the total project cost. Above that, you might have mezzanine debt, another 10 to 20% higher interest rate, and the mezz lender can take over the project if you default. Above that, preferred equity. Investors who get a fixed return before the common equity sees a dime. Then at the top, common equity, the actual ownership stake. That's the developer's own money and their investment partner's money.
The developer is sitting in the middle of this layer cake, juggling everyone's different expectations.
Different return expectations, different time horizons, different risk tolerances. The senior lender wants their interest payments and their principal back. They don't care about your IRR. The mezz lender wants 15 to 20%, and they'll foreclose if they don't get it. The preferred equity wants their 12% preferred return. The common equity wants whatever's left, and if the project underperforms, there might be nothing left.
The developer's actual equity, their own cash, is the first to get wiped out if things go wrong.
And this is where the leverage obsession comes from. Manhattan developers routinely operate at 80 to 90% loan to cost. That means for a $500 million project, the developer might only have 50 to 100 million of actual equity at risk, their own money plus their partners. A 10% drop in property value wipes out the entire equity position. A 20% drop and the senior lender starts getting nervous.
You're permanently one market hiccup away from losing everything.
And this is not hypothetical. Look at 666 Fifth Avenue. Jared Kushner's father Charles bought it in 2006 for $1.8 billion, the highest price ever paid for a U.S. office building at the time. The Kushners put up about $500 million in equity and borrowed the rest. The deal was structured with the assumption that they could raise rents dramatically, convert some of the retail space, and refinance before the debt came due.
Then 2008 happened.
Office rents in Midtown dropped. The retail market cratered. By 2009, the property was worth less than the debt on it. The Kushners spent the next 7 years, from 2009 to 2016, restructuring that debt, fending off lenders, renegotiating terms, bringing in new partners. Jared Kushner's entire professional life during that period was a permanent negotiation against a ticking clock.
Which means his formative experience as a developer wasn't building things, it was managing a crisis.
He wasn't the guy who developed 666 Fifth. His father bought it 2 years before the crash. Jared's job was keeping the lenders at bay, and that's a very specific skill set. It teaches you that every deadline is negotiable, that every counterparty can be squeezed, that walking away and threatening to hand back the keys is a legitimate tactic.
Hand back the keys. That's the deed in lieu of foreclosure, right?
In commercial real estate, if a project goes bad, the developer can essentially say to the lender, "Here are the keys, the property is yours, I'm walking away." It's a structured exit. Trump has done this repeatedly, 6 corporate bankruptcies in 1991, 1992, 2004, 2009, and twice in 2014. Each time, he treated it as a business restructuring. The Trump Taj Mahal Casino in Atlantic City, opened in 1990, filed for bankruptcy in 1991. He walked away, renegotiated debt, kept operating.
In his mind, that's not failure. That's strategy.
That is exactly the point. In real estate development, bankruptcy is not a moral failing. It's a tool. It's a renegotiation lever. Lenders don't want to own half-finished buildings. They're not operators. So the developer has leverage even in distress. The message is, work with me, restructure my debt, or you get stuck managing a construction site.
That's the daily reality. Now paint the regulatory side, because you mentioned zoning hearings and borough presidents. Manhattan is not a place where you just buy land and build.
Manhattan might be the most heavily regulated development market in the United States. You have the Department of Buildings, the City Planning Commission, the Board of Standards and Appeals, the Landmarks Preservation Commission, community boards, borough presidents, the City Council. Any project of significant size requires navigating multiple layers of discretionary approval.
Discretionary is the key word there.
It's everything. There's a fundamental distinction in development between as-of-right and discretionary approvals. As-of-right means the zoning code says you can build X, and if your plans comply, you get your permit. No hearings, no politics. Discretionary means someone, a commissioner, a council member, a board, has to say yes, and their decision can be influenced.
Developers hate discretionary approvals.
They despise them. Discretionary approvals introduce uncertainty, delay, and cost. A rezoning process can take 2 to 3 years. A landmarks review can add 18 months. Every month of delay is carrying costs, interest, and a ticking construction loan maturity date. So developers develop an instinct, push everything toward as of right wherever possible. When you can't, deploy intense personal lobbying. Show up at the council member's fundraiser. Hire the former deputy mayor as a consultant. Make the personal phone call.
Trump's first big Manhattan deal was the Grand Hyatt Hotel in 1978, right next to Grand Central Terminal. That involved a 40-year tax abatement from the city, worth something like $400 million in today's dollars.
The Commodore Hotel was a failing property. Trump, he was in his early 30s at the time, convinced the city to give him a 40-year property tax abatement, which was unprecedented for a commercial project. He got the Hyatt Corporation to operate it. He personally negotiated with the mayor's office, with the city's economic development people, with the banks. The deal worked, the hotel opened in 1980 and was profitable. But the lesson he internalized was, political connections plus personal pressure plus audacity equals win.
That lesson carries forward 45 years.
It carries forward directly. But let's pause on the time pressure specifically, because it's the engine that drives everything else. A typical construction loan has a 2 to 3 year term, with maybe 2 1-year extension options. From the day you break ground, you are racing the maturity date. If you don't complete construction, lease up the building, and stabilize the cash flow before the loan comes due, you have to refinance or extend. And lenders charge for extensions, typically 50 to 100 basis points plus fees.
Every month of delay literally costs you money.
Every month of delay erodes the IRR, increases the risk of default, and gives the lender leverage over you. This creates a permanent crisis mentality. The developer is constantly managing toward the next deadline, the next closing, the next refinancing. There is no long-term steady state. There is only the next deal.
That's the worldview. That's the cognitive toolkit. So let's map it. We've described the pressure cooker. Now, how does this specific set of instincts show up in Iran negotiations?
I count at least 6 direct transfers. Let me go through them. First, time pressure as a weapon. In real estate, the loan maturity date is leverage. The developer uses it to pressure contractors, tenants, and occasionally lenders themselves. In the Iran context, Trump uses deadlines the same way. The May 2018 withdrawal from the JCPOA was followed by 90-day and 180-day wind-down periods for different sanctions. The Maximum Pressure 2.0 campaign has escalating deadlines built in, sanctions relief tied to specific milestones with time limits. It's exactly the structure of a construction loan extension negotiation.
You have until X date, or the deal gets worse. That's the contractor conversation.
That's the subcontractor renegotiation at 2 p.m. Second, the extreme opening position. In Manhattan real estate, you never open with your real number. You ask for the moon and negotiate down to something that still favors you. Trump's position on Iran is zero enrichment, period. No centrifuges, no stockpile, no nothing. That's not a realistic negotiating position. It's an opening bid designed to make whatever you eventually accept look like a concession.
Zero enrichment as an opening bid means even allowing a monitored civilian program becomes the compromise.
Which might be the goal. Third, and this is the big one, leverage obsession. In real estate, leverage is financial. You borrow as much as possible because it amplifies returns. In diplomacy, leverage is economic sanctions and military threat. Trump and Kushner view leverage as the only thing that matters. Not trust, not relationships, not international norms, not alliance management. If you have enough leverage, you can force any outcome.
Which explains the Soleimani strike in January 2020.
The Soleimani strike was not a strategic decision in the traditional sense. It was a leverage play. Qasem Soleimani was Iran's most effective military commander, the architect of their proxy network across the Middle East. Killing him was a demonstration. We can reach out and touch anyone, anywhere, and there's nothing you can do about it. The message was, our leverage is absolute, now come to the table. That's a developer showing up to a zoning hearing having already bought 3 of the 5 council votes.
I don't need to convince you. I just need you to count the votes.
Fourth, the as-of-right mentality in diplomacy. Remember, developers hate discretionary approvals. They want to bypass public hearings, community boards, all the messy democratic processes. Trump's foreign policy shows the same instinct. Unilateral executive orders. Withdrawal from multilateral frameworks. The JCPOA was a multilateral agreement. The US, Iran, the UK, France, Germany, Russia, China, the EU. Trump walked away from it unilaterally in May 2018. He didn't try to renegotiate within the framework. He torched the framework and started over bilaterally.
The snapback of UN sanctions in September 2025. That was the US acting unilaterally to trigger a mechanism in a deal it had already left.
Which is legally contested by almost every other signatory, but the administration did it anyway. As of right. Fifth, the personalization of negotiations. In NYC real estate, deals happen between individuals. You don't negotiate with an institution. You negotiate with a specific developer, a specific lender, a specific council member. Trump's entire diplomatic style reflects this. He insists on direct, one-on-one meetings. He bypassed the State Department bureaucracy constantly in his first term. He met with Kim Jong-un in Singapore and Hanoi with minimal institutional preparation.
Kushner was the back channel, the family office approach to diplomacy.
Jared Kushner, whose diplomatic experience before 2017 was exactly zero, was given the Middle East peace portfolio, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade renegotiation, and a significant role in China policy. Because in the developer's worldview, what matters is personal trust, personal relationships, and the ability to close. Institutions are obstacles. The State Department is a community board hearing, slow, process-obsessed, full of people who can say no.
The deep state, as the Board of Standards and Appeals.
That's exactly how they see it. And sixth, and this might be the most important, the exit strategy problem. In real estate, you can always walk away from a bad deal. Bankruptcy, deed in lieu, sell at a loss, hand back the keys. The developer's downside is capped. Sovereign states cannot do this. If the U.S. walks away from the JCPOA and Iran restarts its enrichment program, the U.S. cannot simply hand back the keys to the Middle East and walk away. The consequences are not contained.
The developer's risk tolerance is calibrated for an environment where failure is recoverable. Nuclear proliferation is not that environment.
It's fundamentally not. And this is the blind spot. In real estate, if you overleverage and the market turns, you lose money. Maybe you lose the project. Maybe you file for bankruptcy. But you can come back. Trump did it multiple times. In nuclear diplomacy, if you overleverage and the other side calls your bluff, you get a nuclear-armed Iran. There is no restructuring that outcome.
Let's test this framework against specific decisions. The May 2018 JCPOA withdrawal. Walk me through it in developer terms.
The JCPOA was a deal. Signed in July 2015 by the Obama administration, the P5+1, and Iran. It limited Iran's enrichment to 3.67%. Capped the stockpile at 300 kilograms, reduced centrifuges by 2/3, and established the most intrusive inspections regime ever negotiated. In exchange, sanctions relief. Trump looked at this deal and said, essentially, this is a bad deal. The sunset clauses mean restrictions expire after 10 to 15 years. The deal doesn't cover ballistic missiles. It doesn't address Iran's regional behavior. I didn't negotiate this deal, and I can get a better one.
That's developer thinking. I didn't sign this contract. The terms don't work for me. I'm walking.
Walking away from a signed contract is normal in real estate if the economics shift. You might lose your deposit, you might get sued, but those are calculable risks. The problem is that walking away from a multilateral nuclear agreement is not the same category of action. When the U.S. withdrew, Iran was still complying with the deal. The III confirmed it repeatedly. The other signatories wanted to preserve it. The U.S. was isolated. And the consequence was that Iran restarted enrichment, and by 2025 had enriched uranium to near weapons-grade levels.
The snapback in September 2025. That was the U.S. asserting its right as an original JCPOA participant to reimpose all U.N. sanctions, even though it had left the deal. The other parties said that was legally invalid. The U.S. did it anyway.
As of right. I don't need your approval. I'm asserting my right, and you can challenge it if you want, but by the time you do, the sanctions will be in place. That's a developer filing a permit application that pushes the boundaries of the zoning code, knowing the city can challenge it, but betting they won't.
Maximum Pressure 2.0, the current sanctions campaign. How does that map onto the developer toolkit?
Maximum Pressure 2.0 is structured like a construction loan negotiation. You have escalating sanctions, tranches tied to deadlines. You have specific, measurable demands. Enrichment levels, stockpile limits, IEEI access, ballistic missile restrictions. You have a clear end state that the administration says it wants, a comprehensive deal. But the path from here to there requires Iran to make sequential concessions under time pressure. Every tranche of sanctions relief is contingent on a verified deliverable.
Which sounds reasonable on paper.
It sounds completely reasonable. It's how you'd structure a real estate deal. The contractor finishes the foundation, you release the first draw, the steel is erected, second draw, the facade is complete, third draw. But Iran is not a contractor, and nuclear weapons development is not a construction project. The asymmetry is that Iran can wait. The regime has survived 40 plus years of sanctions, isolation, and pressure. Its time horizon is fundamentally different from a developer's.
The developer's time horizon is 2 to 5 years. The nuclear proliferation time horizon is 10 to 20.
And that mismatch means the administration systematically undervalues long-term verification and overvalues short-term concessions. A deal that gets Iran to ship out 60% of its enriched uranium stockpile in the next 6 months looks like a win. But if the verification regime collapses after 3 years and Iran reconstitutes, was it a win?
What are we actually learning here? What's the actionable takeaway for someone trying to understand what's happening right now?
First, when analyzing any Trump administration foreign policy move, ask, what would a developer do? It predicts behavior better than traditional international relations frameworks. Realism, liberalism, constructivism. Those assume states act according to certain logics. The developer model assumes the decision maker acts according to the logic of a Manhattan real estate closing, and it's remarkably predictive.
Give me an example of where the IR framework fails and the developer framework works.
Realism would predict that a great power would cultivate alliances to balance against rivals. The developer framework predicts that alliances are only valuable if they can be leveraged for a deal. This explains why Trump has been willing to strain NATO relationships, question the U.S.-Japan security alliance, and treat allies as counterparties rather than partners. In a real estate deal, there are no allies. There are only parties across the table. The mismatch between real estate time horizons and nuclear proliferation time horizons means the administration systematically undervalues verification and overvalues headline concessions. If you're watching the June 2026 talks, pay attention to what's being traded for what. A deal that delivers a dramatic near-term concession, say, Iran agreeing to dismantle its advanced centrifuges at Fort Dow in exchange for sanctions relief that can be reversed later, might look great on paper. But if the verification mechanisms have a short half-life, the long-term outcome is worse than no deal. Watch for deal closing behavior. Sudden deadlines that appear arbitrary. Maximalist last-minute demands. Personalization of the talks. Trump insisting on direct meetings with the Supreme Leader or the President, bypassing the negotiating teams. These are signals that the real estate mindset is driving the process rather than the diplomatic one. When you see a sudden deadline, ask, is this driven by strategic necessity, or is this a developer trying to create urgency to force a close?
The offer expires Friday. The oldest line in real estate.
It works in real estate because there's always another buyer, another seller, another project. In nuclear diplomacy, there is only one Iran. If you bluff and they don't blink, you have no alternative deal to pivot to.
I want to push on something. You've described this as a cognitive toolkit, a set of instincts shaped by a specific professional environment. But isn't there a risk of overdetermining this? Plenty of developers don't think this way. Plenty of diplomats come from business backgrounds.
That's fair. The framework doesn't explain everything. Personal psychology matters. Domestic political incentives matter. but professional path dependency is underrated as an explanatory variable. If you spend 30 years in an environment where every problem is a deal to be closed, where leverage is everything, where walking away is always an option, and where personal relationships substitute for institutional processes, those instincts become your default. You don't consciously choose to apply them. They're just how you see the world.
The specific environment matters. A developer in Houston or Atlanta operates differently. The regulatory environment is lighter. The capital stacks are simpler. The time pressure is less intense. Manhattan is uniquely brutal.
Manhattan is uniquely brutal because the land values are the highest in the country. The regulatory environment is the most complex. The construction costs are astronomical, and the competition for sites, tenants, and capital is ferocious. It selects for a certain personality type, aggressive, relentless, comfortable with chaos, and utterly convinced that the deal is the only thing that matters.
Let's talk about what this framework misses. What are the blind spots?
The biggest blind spot is the assumption that every problem has a deal-based solution. In real estate, you can always do a deal. Maybe the terms are worse than you wanted, maybe you take a loss, but there's always a transaction that resolves the situation. In geopolitics, some problems don't have deal-based solutions. Iran's ideological commitment to its regional proxy network is not a negotiating position. It's a core element of the regime's identity and security doctrine. You can't buy it out with sanctions relief.
What's the price of Hezbollah? Is not a question with an answer.
It's not. The second blind spot is alliance management. In a real estate deal, you don't have allies. You have counterparties. In diplomacy, allies are force multipliers. They provide legitimacy, intelligence, economic weight, and military capability. Treating them as counterparties to be squeezed erodes that force multiplication. The European signatories to the JCPOA spent years trying to preserve the deal after the U.S. withdrawal. They eventually gave up. That's a loss of leverage, not a gain.
The third blind spot, irreversibility. Some actions can't be walked back.
If you kill Qasem Soleimani, you can't unkill him. If Iran restarts enrichment to 60%, you can't unenrich that uranium. If you withdraw from a multilateral agreement and trigger snapback, you can't restore the status quo ante. The developer's assumption that every deal can be restructured, every mistake can be walked back, every loss can be recovered, that assumption does not hold in nuclear diplomacy.
Where does this leave us? Looking at the June 2026 talks.
The developer framework predicts a few things. One, the administration will push for a dramatic, time-limited agreement, something that can be announced as a win before the midterms. Two, it will demand maximalist concessions on enrichment and stockpiles while offering sanctions relief that can be reversed. Three, it will personalize the negotiations. Trump will want to be seen closing the deal himself. Four, if the talks fail, the administration will blame Iran's unreasonableness and walk away, because that's what developers do when a counterparty won't meet their terms.
They were never serious. The line after every failed deal.
In real estate, that's a perfectly fine thing to say. You move on to the next project. The problem is that in nuclear diplomacy, there is no next project. There's just the centrifuges still spinning.
The most dangerous blind spot might be the assumption that walking away is always an option. Because walking away from Iran doesn't make Iran go away. It makes Iran unconstrained.
Unconstrained, enriched to near weapons grade, with a demonstrated ability to strike regional adversaries through proxies, and with no incentive to negotiate because the U.S. has shown it will tear up agreements when administrations change. That's the world the developer mindset creates, not because anyone intends it, but because the toolkit wasn't designed for this problem.
The structural mismatch is the story. It's not about whether the people are good or bad, smart or dumb. It's that they brought a toolkit optimized for two-year construction loans to a problem that unfolds over decades.
They don't know they're doing it. That's the thing about professional path dependency. You don't notice the grooves because you've been in them your whole career. Every instinct feels like common sense. Every tactic feels like how business is done. The idea that nuclear diplomacy might require a different set of instincts. Patience over pressure, institutions over individuals, long-term verification over short-term concessions. That idea doesn't compute, because in the developer's world, those instincts lose you money.
Here's the question I keep coming back to. Can a negotiation style optimized for 2-year construction loans succeed in a domain where the consequences unfold over decades? I don't think we know the answer yet, but we're running the experiment in real time.
The results so far are not encouraging. The 2018 withdrawal led to Iran restarting enrichment. The maximum pressure campaign brought Iran to the table but didn't produce a deal in the first term. The snapback was legally contested and diplomatically isolating. The current round of talks has the same structural features, time pressure, maximalist demands, personalization, that produced the previous outcomes.
If the talks fail this year, the developer framework predicts the administration will blame the counterparty and walk away, not because it's strategic, but because that's the script.
Walking away from a nuclear threshold state is fundamentally different from walking away from a building. The building stays where it is. Someone else buys it, renovates it, moves on. The nuclear program keeps spinning.
The assumption that every problem has a deal-based solution might be the most expensive assumption in American foreign policy right now.
It's certainly the one with the highest potential cost. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1970s, a pigment chemist in Madagascar developed a shade of blue using cobalt aluminate and a rare earth dopant that was so stable it could survive kiln firing at 1400 degrees Celsius without shifting hue. He named it Antananarivo Azure, and exactly one batch was ever produced. The formula was lost when his laboratory flooded during a cyclone in 1979.
Somewhere, there's a single batch of the most stable blue ever made, and nobody can make more.
The world's most durable pigment, and it's a one-off. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify. We're back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.